Recent incidents of street violence in Waikiki have turned public attention toward its population of street kids, homeless runaways who have had to fend for themselves in an environment that carries more than its share of dangers. Kent Anderson, Chief High-Risk Services Officer of YO, Youth Outreach, works with this troubled population every day and says these kids are far more likely to be victims of crimes than they are to commit them.
There's a lot of misperceptions and myths about the young people we work with, but probably one of the most common is that it's a bunch of bad kids who are on the streets, that it's kids looking for trouble. In reality, who we serve, there's kids on the streets, but they're looking for survival. And they've had a rough life. Most of our kids have been the victims of either physical, sexual, or emotional abuse in the home. And they escape a damaging environment. And they often have no healthy place to turn, so they turn to the streets. And because of that, their life becomes far more complicated.
How do they come to into your world?
Waikiki Health and Halekipa, we jointly run a program called Youth Outreach. And we've been running this program since 1989 in Waikiki. And we serve over 700 youth, homeless and at-risk youth, per year. And the way they get to us is through many ways, but mostly it's through word of mouth. On the streets, YO's been around for so many decades that the kids know that it's there and it's a resource for them. And what's funny is there are some youth who are more troublemakers that the kids don't tell about YO because they want to keep it a safe place, they want to keep it a respite, and they want to keep it a healthy environment. So most of the youth know it. I mean, we've talked to a lot of high schools and such. They know, many of them know the resource, especially the kids, not always the counselors, but we're trying to increase that awareness. But the challenge we face is we also have to keep our services confidential because our youth are at such a high risk of exploitation and they're at such a high risk of harm that we need to keep them protected. So, for example, we will not publicize the physical location of where we do our services because we don't want to put our youth at risk. Similar to what a domestic violence shelter would do is that they don't want people to know where they're at, except for those who need the services.
What kind of exploitation? What kind of harm?
Well, there's a lot of things. There's definitely a major issue with sex trafficking. I've seen some stats that show the average youth on the streets is pursued for sex trafficking within 48 hours. It's shocking just how quickly and how efficient it can be that when somebody's new to the streets,
you get spotted.
That they get spotted and they get targeted. So there's a huge issue. And when we say sex trafficking, that's obviously could be sex trafficking for money on the streets, but also there's a lot of survival sex. There's a lot of type of predatory practices that happens. And it's not just, some people think it's just the females. No, it's the males and the females who are both getting targeted and getting pursued for these types of things.
Survival sex, what's that?
Survival sex is basically trading sex for money or for food.
Shelter.
Or for shelter or for whatever you need. So it's not necessarily prostitution as the way we think of it, but a lot of times there's kids who, and this isn't just on the streets, this is throughout society, and it's not just youth, but youth are extra targeted, that there's a lot of people who will take advantage of people in need and looking for basic resources, and sex is one form of capital that's been used regularly.
When you say that kids will get approached within 48 hours, what does the approach consist of?
It can mean a lot of things. I haven't personally witnessed one directly, in all sincerity. Fortunately, we have a staff who's out on the streets, and they are, to be blunt, a bit more educated on the day-to-day realities that I'm dealt with. But from what I've seen and what I've shared with my team and what they've shared with me, better said, is that there'll be a youth on the street. Whether it be drugs, whether it be food, just very direct. A lot of times it's youth approaching other youth because there are ways that if some youth who are already being exploited help recruit others, they actually can get special treatment and special favors and things like that. There's a lot of different ways, but a lot of times it's just there's a youth who's on the streets who is scared and they're hungry and they're tired and they don't have a place, and somebody comes out to them showing that they can take care of in a very kind way a lot of times first. It's not
a pimp.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that they see this person as a way out of their current trouble. And when you're looking for daily survival, sometimes you make choices to survive that day.
Mm-hmm.
And the worse it gets, the more desperate you come a lot of time.
It makes it sound, that whole thing of the approach within 48 hours makes it sound as if there's a pretty well-organized infrastructure to this whole human trafficking thing.
Absolutely.
Somebody's going to spot you, and a pimp is going to approach you and have, you know, have his rap ready for you. This is what I'm offering. This is what I can do for you. And here's another kid who says it's okay. You know, the kid your age, right?
Absolutely. It's a very, very troubling problem. And it's a problem where our youth, they're being victimized. Yet a lot of times we have situations where people want to target them as the troublemaker. I'll never take away individual choice, but people also make decisions when they're in stress, when they're in trauma, and when they're in need. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people do what they have to do to survive.
You see a lot of that on the street, and I'm wondering on any given night in Waikiki, how many kids are out there?
Now, there's a lot of kids who hang out on the streets in Waikiki just for fun, for socialization. That's where a lot of action is. That's where a lot of activity
sure.
are. But if you're talking about the ones who are actually homeless or the ones who are the street youth,
yeah,
shall
kids
we say?
Are out on the street without knowing where they're going to sleep at.
Yeah, so it varies, but it's spread a lot. It's not just Waikiki. I mean, it used to be historically more in Waikiki, but through the Compassionate Disruption Campaign, there was a lot of shifting. So there's some still in Waikiki. A lot of it's moved to Kakoako. A lot of it's moved under the bridges on near the airport. It's actually spread throughout the whole state. But Waikiki still is a magnet. There's no doubt about that. And I can say on an average day we have a drop-in center where the kids can get things like a shower, food, laundry, basic needs services. We see on an average day at the drop-in center 20 to 60 on an average day. I can say we serve over 700 per year. And not everyone accesses the drop-in center. So there's a lot of folks who are just on the streets at night without accessing those types of day resources.
Has Compassionate Disruption made your job easier or tougher?
It's actually made, for Yo, our job a lot tougher, because one of the benefits when youth were congregating in specific locations is that you could organize resources and organize approaches to reach the youth. We know with certainty that a lot of our youth actually returned to some unhealthy practices such as survival sex. Some returned to a pimp. Some returned to unhealthy situations as they were trying to flee when they were told they have to move.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get into the political arguments there's obviously pluses and minuses mm-hmm. to this type of approach, but I can say specifically for outreaching and connecting these kids to services and helping them make healthier choices, we have seen a lot of struggles and challenges, especially because the youth were moved, but they weren't really moved into healthier environments. They were just told to leave as
moved.
Opposed to put into healthy shelters mm-hmm. or healthy types of resources.
Well, Kent, if you had your druthers, what would you like to see changed?
Oh, there's a lot of things I like to see change, but I would say if I had my druthers, I like to look at systemic approaches. The biggest thing is we really need to provide better love and support to all of our kids, and that comes down to the family level and the community level. I mean, we like to look at institutions, but the first institution is the family.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of kids, as I mentioned earlier, who they're just dealt a bad hand. They're dealing with fear. They're dealing with violence. They're dealing with abuse, and that's just not right. No kid deserves to be in that environment. So my first step, my druthers, as mm-hmm. you would say, is we need to really do better as a community, and that comes at the nuclear family, but that comes at the extended family. That can permeate through the school systems, that can permeate through the business community, that can permeate through government. We're not seeing a improvement on the number of kids on the streets or the number of kids who are dealing with crisis and trauma. So systemically, we need to come together as a community. I know that's a big ask, but I don't think one program here or there is going to solve the issues we're dealing with alone. It has to be a community response. And for the, that's for the younger kids especially. And then as the kids get older, we're dealing with a lot of kids who drop out of school. We're dealing with a lot of kids who now they're adults and they're still on the streets. We really need to do a better job of finding what I'll call mentorship opportunities, what I would call internships, things like that, with to help our youth really establish skills that they can actually sustainably live on. I mean, I love the restaurant jobs. I love those types of service jobs. They're fantastic. But most of them don't pay enough to actually have a place and to live if you're doing that for 40 hours per week. And a lot of our youth are working. People don't know that. We have a lot of youth who are working, and a lot of our youth are trying to pursue their school aspirations. But it's hard to do that when you're not sleeping at night because you're afraid to get beat up. So we need more supports for the kids, for all kids, but especially those who are in a bad situation. I'm thankful for things like the foster care system, and I'm thankful for Child Protective Services, but we just collectively need to work together to do better in all fronts.
Kent Anderson is the Chief High-Risk Services Officer of YO, Youth Outreach, which describes itself as a safe haven for homeless youths, offering medical care, social services, and support. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, bringing a community together in a search for a cure. But first, your quiz. Later in the program, we'll hear about a film that tells the story of a Hawaiian veteran of the Vietnam War. Today's backyard quiz also takes us to Vietnam in search of a common garden herb. The Vietnamese coriander is an herbal staple in Southeast Asian cooking. Used in a variety of dishes, this coriander is found in salads, raw spring rolls, beef noodle bowls, and as a garnish. The Vietnamese coriander is a perennial plant that grows best in tropical and subtropical climates, making it a favorite for local Hawaii gardeners. The top of its leaves are dark green with chestnut-colored spots, while the base is burgundy red. Reaching a maximum of 6 inches in height, it's ideal as a house or patio plant. The name can be misleading. Although it has the name coriander, it is actually not part of the mint or coriander family, but rather a perennial herbaceous member of the knotweed family. For today's quiz, can you tell us the botanical name for this plant? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii International Film Festival, featuring Japanese period film Sekigahara and the Made in Hawaii films Proof of Loyalty and Out of State at Regal Dole Cannery Theaters, hiff.org.
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, known as ALS, is a cruel disease, a progressive degeneration of the brain and spinal cord that leads to loss of muscular control and death. As of now, it has no cure. The search for a cure is a life's work for Fred Fisher, president and CEO of the ALS Association. He's in Honolulu for the Hawaii ALS Walk this Saturday, and he's with us in our studio. Fred, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a life's work for you, hasn't it?
It's been a long time. I've been through this long enough to see really the dark ages of ALS, where there was very little reason for hope, to today, where there's more reason than ever to think we're going to have an effective treatment and potentially a cure very soon.
What gives us reason to hope?
Well, technology is really catching up with the disease, and mm-hmm. so we have the ability now to understand the disease in ways we didn't have, and we have technologies that help us create models of the disease in a dish. We don't have to rely just on mouse models or worms or other things where we create animal models of the disease. We can now create human models of ALS in a dish by mm-hmm. converting people's skin cells into stem cells and watching their ALS progress.
What are the areas of study that are most productive at this point?
Well, the ALS Association is pursuing a worldwide effort. We're looking at small molecules, the typical drugs that people would take through a pill or injection. We're looking at gene therapies. There are now two potential therapies targeting specific genes that cause ALS that essentially silence the disease and eliminate it from a person that's been living with it. Stem cell therapies, there are now two clinical trials going on that are looking at how stem cell therapy might actually stop or reverse the progression of the disease.
How is it diagnosed?
So ALS is what's called a rule-out disorder, which means you go to a neurologist with these symptoms. It could be with a dropped foot, or you're having trouble grasping something, or your speech is starting to slur. And they're looking for stroke. They're looking for other neurodegenerative issues mm-hmm. That are easily recognizable and potentially more easily able to treat. And once they rule everything else out, they're left with ALS.
They have that guideline in medicine: when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. You go for the most common possibility. And it looks as if loss of muscular control is the trigger.
That's right. But it can show up in breathing. It can show up in speech. There are people who their employers think they're showing up to work drunk, and that's the first symptom expression. Mm-hmm. It can be a trip and a fall. So we don't have necessarily horse hooves. We've got a lot of different symptom expression. That's part of what's so complicated about diagnosing the disease and treating the disease, is that it doesn't express itself the same way in a group of people, and it doesn't progress in the same way in a group of people, and it doesn't even progress at the same rate in a group of people. And that in particular makes clinical trials very challenging for ALS.
Yeah, I can certainly see how. How long does it, from the time you're diagnosed, how long do you have?
So the short answer is we don't know. Mm-hmm. There are people who've been living with ALS for longer than I've been working for the ALS Association, so more than 14 years. I know people who've been living with ALS for 30 years. The American Medical Association recognizes ALS as a chronic disease. There are also people who die within 6 months of being diagnosed. On average, it's 2 to 5 years from diagnosis to death, mm-hmm. Which is why we want to get people diagnosed very quickly, and we want to give them access to our multidisciplinary model of care very quickly, because it is the only thing that's proven to help people live meaningfully longer and better.
Whenever a deadly disease like this moves as quickly as it does, it tends to cause a kind of panic in its patients, which can lead them to search for what might politely be called alternative therapies.
That's true. There's a tremendous amount of desperation and urgency, which my staff and I try to match in terms of searching for a cure and getting people access to the help they need. Mm-hmm. But we often can't be the obstacle to their pursuit, their grasp at unrealistic hope. And mm-hmm. the unfortunate thing is there are people in the world who are ready to take advantage of that. So I talk to a lot of people that say, hey, I heard about this stem cell therapy in Eastern Europe. What do you think? And my answer is there's no evidence that that works. If it did, we'd know about it, and mm-hmm. we'd be bringing it here immediately. But it doesn't stop people from spending tens of thousands of dollars in chasing that when they're going to need that money to underwrite the cost of their care.
It's puts you in an awkward position warning people against quackery, of which there's plenty out there, without discouraging people from trying to get well.
That's exactly right. And so human nature is a complicated and interesting thing, and it is not for me to get in the way of anyone's self-determination, but it is for me to help people understand what's their best option, what are the best choices, what's the best course of action that we know of, and then you're free to make the decision.
We've heard with other conditions that research is sometimes driven by what the audience for the research is, how many people will be affected, how much money is worth it for industries and academic institutions to pursue the search for a cure. Is the motivation there for ALS?
This is actually where ALS has some advantages. In the neurodegenerative disease space, which includes Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, frontal temporal dementia, ALS is the one that researchers are most interested in, most excited about on some level, because unlike those other diseases, you can watch ALS progress pretty quickly, which makes it possible for you to test drugs on people and see if they're working. With mm-hmm. diseases that progress much more slowly, like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, that have much bigger patient populations, by mm-hmm. the way, it's very hard to detect a signal. In a disease where you don't have a biomarker, you don't have a way to say, oh, this drug is hitting that target, when you don't have that in ALS for the most part, all you have is the ability to watch symptom expression. And you can watch it continue, you can watch it speed up, you can watch it slow down. And that's how clinical trials are conducted. And so ALS being a disease that moves quickly, you can detect whether or not a drug is working quickly. And so scientists and drug companies are very interested in ALS because they figure that if they unlock the key to ALS, they're going to unlock the keys to Parkinson's, Huntington's, Alzheimer's, and the other neurodegenerative diseases.
That would be a fantastic advance in medicine, wouldn't it, Fred?
It'll be amazing, and it's part of why this work is so gratifying. The people who are living with ALS are amazing. And we are doing pioneering work. We are doing change the world work. And we are going to find something that makes an enormous difference, not just for people living with ALS, but we're going to be making breakthroughs in neurodegenerative disease research, which is among the fastest growing disease segments there is. These neurodegenerative diseases now make up the fifth leading cause of death in the country. And so this is a big space. It's a big problem, and it's exciting to be part of it.
Thanks very much for being with us, Fred.
Thank you.
Fred Fisher is the president and CEO of the ALS Association here in Hawaii for the Walk to Defeat ALS this Saturday, starting at Kapi'olani Park at 9:30 a.m. You can find details on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Straighten up and fly right with the U.S. Air Force Band of the Pacific. On November 11th, their Small Kind Acoustic Ensemble will be rocking your favorite tunes in a free concert in HPR's Atherton Studio. Reserve your seat at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
The Honolulu Police Department's new chief, Susan Ballard, takes office accompanied by a chorus of praise from her colleagues for her integrity and her fairness, a tacit acknowledgement that those qualities were lacking in her troubled predecessor. In today's Civil Beat Reality Check, reporter Louis Kanea looks at what Ballard's past career can tell us about what we can expect from her. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Thanks for talking with us. It's kind of time to look at her past career for clues to what the future is going to be like, yeah?
Right. So, she has an extensive history with HPD. She's been there for 32 years, and she has worked in many, many different divisions, including her stint as the commander of two different districts, and also worked at the right before she was appointed a chief, she was at the Central Receiving Division. She knows the department inside and out. I think that will be a huge advantage for her to move forward and, really just hit the road running as soon as she's ready to do that. I guess, starting date is really yesterday, so.
Well, all the chorus of support has contained a great many comments that sounded like an admission that just how deep the problems went before she came along.
I think, the Chief Ballard herself was saying this, the morale was pretty much down within the department, and she was pretty angry at what's been transpiring, basically outside now at the federal court with the former chief, Louis K. Aloha. I think people are kind of anxious to move forward and, actually just put their head down and just do their job. And that's kind of what she has been saying all along.
There's a pending lawsuit that you mentioned in your article. Tell me about that, if you would.
So this is kind of a tricky case because this was filed back in 2009. At the time, Chief Ballard was the commander of the police academy. This lawsuit was filed by this officer who was an instructor there at the time. She alleges in the lawsuit that there has been some altering of test scores so that some of the recruits who were not qualified could still join the force because the department were short on officers, basically, at the time. The case is still alive, and it's been dragging on for this many years, but it hasn't really progressed. They're supposedly still going through this discovery and a deposition process, and any of the evidence that this the plaintiff alleges, it's not really backed up by any of the documents or discovery proof. So at this point, it is an allegation made in this lawsuit, the Chief Ballard has not spoken publicly about it. I know that the police commission, which was selecting her out of the seven candidates, were aware of this going in, even with the this lawsuit pending, they chose her and saying she was the best candidate out of the seven.
Well, at this point,
so we'll see.
At this point, it's nothing more than an allegation, and even by the standards of civil trials, that's 8 years is a long time to move toward a resolution, isn't it?
Yeah, that is true. So, we'll definitely be watching how where this lawsuit would go.
Yeah.
I'm kind of anxious to talk to her about this and also, so many other policy decisions she would have to make as the chief now.
Well, that'll be interesting.
She has not been available since she was appointed, but, we'll catch her one of those days.
I don't doubt it. Thanks a lot. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Louis Kanea.
Eggs, check. Milk, check. Going grocery shopping with a list in hand is an age-old way to be efficient. But what about bringing checklists beyond the supermarket?
If those checklists had not been integrated to that level at the start of World War II, it's reasonable to assume that many hundreds and probably thousands of lives would have been lost.
The life-saving power of the checklist. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
Filmmaker Brian Cohn grew up on Maui watching the U.S. Navy drop bombs on Kaho'olawe just offshore. The memory has stayed with him. It's part of the reason he wrote and directed his new movie, Kuleana. It's the story of a disabled Vietnam vet who comes home to the islands and reconnects with his Hawaiian identity. Brian's with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
Kohol-Ave is kind of in the background of the action of your movie, but it's a big part of your inspiration, isn't it?
Truly so. It burned a hole in my heart watching this island from the time I moved here at age 5, watching this island be annihilated every single day. So as the years went on, and in the 70s, my family was involved in the Protect Kohol-Ave Ohana. Certainly people on Maui had a first-hand seat to what was happening with the island. And I first went to the island around 81, 82. And so as an artist, it's something that I knew eventually that I'd get around to saying something about. And that's one of the things we're addressing in Kuleana.
What did it look like to you as a kid?
It was horrific, day and night. We lived in Ma'alaya, so I could see the bombs being dropped. And at night, it was like akin to fireworks. The ground would shake. Ripples would come ashore. And as a child, I'd ask adults, what is that? And they'd say, the Navy's bombing the island, as though it was okay. Mm-hmm. People weren't necessarily doing anything about it. But as time wore on with George Helm and others, and the Protect Kohol-Ave Ohana, Emmett Aluli and others became deeply involved, Walter Riddy, then it took on a greater level of importance, I think, for all of us.
How is that reflected in the action of your movie?
Well, the issue is sort of going on in the background, and it almost serves as an allegory for what's going on internally in my main character, Nohea, a Hawaiian who's certainly challenged to embrace his kuleana. His disposition, and he's missing a leg, so he has even greater challenges. The identity, the loss of identity, and degradation of his family, the possible loss of their family land. He's indifferent to all of it. He just wants out of here. So at the beginning of the movie, this is a man who wants nothing to do with any of it, and by the end, his attitude shifts.
And this is 1971. He's come back from Vietnam, a disabled vet.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really amazing movie. And you're a musician, and I think that anybody who loves music and music and cinema is going to love the various layers in Kuleana. Aside from music of the period, national hits such as Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi and other national stars, mm-hmm. we've managed to license a lot of the most incredible music in the late 60s by artists such as Auntie Genoa Keavi, Lena Machado. There's Marlene Tsai tracks in the movie, mm-hmm. Sons of Hawaii, and Sunday Manoas, and then the music's also rounded up by an original score by Willie Kay. So it's music at that time, music was in our lives through radio.
Yeah.
So radio is a character in this movie as well. Much as if you think about a movie like American Graffiti, Wolfman Jack, you have a personality and all this music. Mm-hmm. Well, our lives at that time, radio was sort of the collective consciousness. And on Maui, we had two AM stations, that was it. So we all listened to the same music. We got the same information, and the radio personalities were family members in a certain way.
Well, in those days, you could have a hit song on AM radio and be making a statement of social engagement at the same time.
Truly so, and it was the day when songwriting was really important. Well, I think in this day and age, there's a lot of great songwriters, but by and large, there's just so much music, and people aren't crafting music like I think we once did.
I remember driving into Chicago, where the tension would always rise when you drove into Chicago in the late 60s, early 70s, when Mayor Daley was there.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I heard Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, how perfect for the times we live in. Ironically, it's perfect for the times we live in today. And I think a lot of the songs of that era that you describe give that feeling, don't you?
I do. And, this afternoon I'm privileged to be able to go and work with the film students at Iolani. And they watched the movie last week, and the teacher sent me a list of questions they're going to have. And at the top of their list, they want to know about the music.
That's interesting.
So there's something, this movie is very provocative. We don't seek to teach or preach. But it's a movie about Hawaiian values and our history and our culture and about the indigenous people. And Olelo Hawaii is really prominent in the movie. And so it seems, based on this, I'm concluding, wow, our movie's also creating curiosity in the youth about this period music. I think, too, a lot of younger folks are listening to, they're listening to really, by and large, shallow music. And so it's not that they can't differentiate. They just don't have access to quality music of depth. So I'm looking forward to this afternoon hearing what they have to say about what they experienced, not only with the narrative, but with the music.
Well, in the movie, it's really about an internal journey that your main character, Noheya, takes, right?
Truly so. That's at the core of it. He's challenged in oh so many ways. But it's an ensemble cast. And so people from Oahu are very familiar with Melka Bang and Augie T. And they're in dramatic roles in this movie. Marlene Tsai is absolutely remarkable in her role. So I'd say there's probably 10 or 12 characters going on that all have fully fleshed out stories. It's a deeply layered movie, but every character faces a choice or a question with respect to their own kuleana. So the movie really is about kuleana at the end of the day.
And I would expect that a viewer would do a little self-examination.
And that,
as a result,
I was asked at the Guam Film Festival in a Q&A a few weeks ago. We were honored with Best of Festival, the Guam International Film Festival, and that was one of the questions. What do you want from this? What is the takeaway, ultimately, and for an audience? And my answer was, I would really love for people to walk out of the theater asking of themselves, what is my kuleana? Because we all have them. And if we're here in Hawaii, we certainly have them to the indigenous people and the culture, the host culture. We can all be part of a solution, or by default, maybe we're the opposite of that. So that's probably what we're after here.
It's pretty much what our choices come down to these days.
Truly so.
Solution or problem.
My identity, how I identify deeply with kuleana, is it's about the importance to honor those who came before while making the world a better place for those who follow. And that's what I think we might just have achieved with this new motion picture, kuleana.
Let's hope you get that result, Brian. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Brian Cohn is the director of kuleana, which will be shown at the Hawaii International Film Festival November 3rd and 5th on Oahu, November 16th and 19th on Hawaii Island. You can get details of the screenings on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Omer Kursat from Waimanalo. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
For today's backyard quiz, we ask you for the scientific name of Vietnamese coriander. Standing 6 inches with reddish stems and brown spotted dark green leaves, this coriander is ideal for house and patio gardeners. It's a staple of Southeast Asian cuisine. You can find it used in a variety of dishes from Vietnamese spring rolls to laksa soup in Singapore and Malaysia. Australia is even investigating the plant's potential as a source for kesam oil. The Vietnamese coriander goes by many names, depending on your geographic location, usually identifying it as a mint, such as the Cambodian mint. However, it shares no relation to the mint or coriander family and is actually a member of the buckwheat family. In 1974, this herb's scientific name was reclassified to Persicaria odorata, but its original name, and the one we were looking for, was Polygonum odoratum, originally classified in 1790. And I guess there aren't too many Latin scholars out there because nobody got that today, but we'll just continue to hope. That's our quiz for today. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où,
si bon.
bras dessus,
si bon.
en chantant des chansons. Oh,
c'est si bon,
si bon, si bon,
de se dire des mots doux,
si bon, si bon,
des petits rien du tout,
si bon, si bon.
If you're going to perform cabaret music in the true French manner, there are three things you'll absolutely need: a singer who's quite at home in the French language, a violin, and an accordion. Lucky for us, L'Escargot has all three. The group is performing this weekend in Honolulu, and Mimi Hafele, Duane Padilla, and Pierre Grill are with us in our studio. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
That's right. I should have. Yeah, why am I talking English at a time like this?
That's right.
Pierre, I suspect that you had a lot to do with originating this particular idea for the concert. Am I right?
I made up that band almost 20 years ago, 1998, for my ex-wife, singer, with Juan de Vilbis on the violin and Ernie Provencher on the bass. And then it was okay. But then when Mimi and Duane became the band, things happened and people like us.
Yeah. Well, what's not to like, right?
Well, anyway, they like us.
What's the mood that you're going for with the music of this group?
We love that word cabaret. Mm-hmm. And so this is really, it's not, we don't want to be lounge. Concert, that's a little much. Cabaret is really the right frame. And we keep it French,
yeah,
against all odds. Most people don't even understand the language, but we do create a nice, wonderful mood. And Mimi is probably the best Edith Piaf in the world right now. She sounds exactly like Edith Piaf.
You know, I grew up on Edith Piaf's music around the house. And Mimi, there's nobody quite like her. She really had a character all her own, didn't she?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not even considering myself to be close to Edith Piaf, but the first time I heard her singing, and I was totally, I was just like, oh my God, this lady, she knows how to sing. And even if she have a short life, because Edith Piaf only, she died when she was like 43 years old, and she left a legacy then nobody will never surpass. Edith Piaf will be always Edith Piaf.
Emotion right there on her sleeve, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Duane, what's your role in this group?
I think my role is just to be the Stefan Grappelli in this French band, so just to throw out beautiful, sweet melodies. And then also, I'm sort of a double hitter in this band, too.
Yeah.
So if we need a rhythm guitar, I'll throw him a rhythm guitar. And the not-so-secret secret of Saturday, I might play an accordion on a tune or two on Saturday. So
you know, every time I meet you, Duane, and I see you fairly often, you've acquired a new instrument. I mean, where does it end?
Yeah, I don't think you've seen my second accordion. This is the second. So you haven't seen this accordion yet. This is the second one.
You're completely scaring me. Let's do a tune, and I'm honored to be joining you. I've sort of requested this tune because it's a big favorite of mine. Mimi, would you introduce La Vie en Rose?
Well,
maybe a little bit about what the song
says. The song is always, that's the life in, I don't want to say in pink, because that's what, it's just a dream life. Everybody has been looking for that, and then she's looking for, she finally the man of her dream, and she closed her eyes, and everything is happening. She hold her in his arms, and the kisses, and all the, everything is about love. Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se porte sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas. Je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui, dans la vie, on se l'est dit, la jurée pour la alors je sens en moi mon cœur.
Terrific. You had another Cole Porter song. Let's sneak that in because I think you've got time.
We were talking about doing a waltz that we never played in our concert called Sous les Ponts de Paris.
Under the
Let's
bridge.
Do it.
In B flat.
Well, I'm going to leave this to you.
Yeah, but this one is a straight waltz, very popular French waltz. And we have guests. We have a singer called Big Dave, a new singer to town. We forced him to sing in French. He's going to do the Cole Porter I Love Paris as a duet. The guy is a phenomenal bel canto singer.
Uh-huh.
We have French can-can dancers, young ones, seven of them doing splits and jumps from the Saint Laurent School Dance. It's saintlaurentschool.com with Kim, their teacher.
Let's and get your song in well before
and
we
have
out
our
of time.
Captain Pilot, Benoit Weber. Okay, let's do the song.
Pour aller à Suresnes ou bien à Charenton, le long de la Seine, on passe sous les ponts pendant le jour suivant son cours. Paris en bateau défile, cœur plein d'entrain, ça va, ça vient, mais le soir lorsque tout dort tranquille. Sous les ponts de Paris, lorsque descend la nuit, toutes sortes de gueux se faufilent aux cachettes et sont heureux de trouver une couchette. Au tel du courant d'air, où l'on ne paye pas cher, parfum et l'eau, c'est pour rien, mon marquis, sous les ponts de Paris. Parfum et l'eau, c'est pour rien, mon marquis, sous les ponts de Paris.
Terrific.
À samedi.
That was, I know that it was about the bridges of Paris, but what else did you say in that song?
Well, she started for some point, so all the bridges, you know, you have in Paris were, I think, like 85, or I'm not really sure about the number, and it goes underneath the bridge, and just like imagine you're on a boat. And then you start from Suresnes, go to Charenton, which is a different place of Paris.
Right.
And then you are on the Seine and going slowly and enjoy every minute of it. Paris.
I'm caught up in the mood already.
And then under the Paris Bridge, you have all the drunks, you know, they have the wine. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Which is where a lot of that music was born.
Right. Bien sûr, alors.
This is the music of the cabaret, and the cabarets tend to spill out into the street, right?
So, yes.
So cabaret life and street life kind of blend together, don't
Absolutely.
They?
And so we're hoping to have a lot of people. They're going to love French music, French cabaret, French dancing on at the Aristocratic Theater on Saturday.
Yeah.
November 4th, 7:30.
Pierre, where did you get this cast of characters?
That's the best of the best. But Dwayne is actually extremely limited kind of a musician. He cannot play violin and guitar at the same time.
Not yet.
Yeah, Not yet.
We're working on that.
He's got to work on this. You know what I mean?
I do.
Because he's so fabulous on both. I mean, just... And now, accordion. In concert. Dwayne on accordion.
Where does it end?
Now he can play the three of them. Now we'll be totally in business.
Yeah. Dwayne, you should consider getting paid three times over, right?
I think so, yes.
Talk to Pierre after the show.
Now we're sleeping down.
Hey, thanks very much, all three
thanks
of you.
So
for
hey, thanks for having us.
Mimi Hafele, Dwayne Padilla, and Pierre Grill are the cabaret ensemble known as L'Escargot. They will perform Saturday evening at the Doris Duke Theater. The show is called Bonjour Paris. Mm-hmm.
cœur ouvert à l'inconnu. J'avais envie de dire bonjour à n'importe qui. N'importe qui, et ce fut toi. Je t'ai dit n'importe quoi. Il suffisait de te parler pour t'apprivoiser. Aux Champs-Élysées. Aux Champs-Élysées.
Hi, my name's Bonnie Rice. I'm a principal at the Rice Partnership Wealth Management, and we're an underwriter of Hawaii Public Radio. People in the community definitely comment that they hear that we're supporting public radio, and we think public radio ranks right up there as another important way we can bring something of value to the communities we serve.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, this is Ray Cruz inviting you to join me on Friday nights from 8 to 10 for Latin Beat. We'll be playing the latest releases in salsa, salsa clásica, and of course, Afro-Cuban Latin jazz and more. All for you here on HPR 1, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. See you then.
That's it for today's show, and up tomorrow, we'll look at an affordable housing solution that originated in New York. It's coming to Hawaii. Tell us what you think about anything you hear on the program. You can call our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more information about today's topics, along with links to our daily podcast. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.